of a small family farm, maybe somewhere in the hills of Wisconsin. Chickens running around outdoors, freshly plowed fields, a few dairy cows. Now imagine a hospital, sterile rooms, gleaming equipment, different worlds, right? Well, physician Daphne Miller believes farming and medicine are intimately linked, and that the insights of the sustainable farming movement could transform modern medicine. Could integrated pest management lead to, say, breakthrough cancer treatments? Could techniques for building healthy soil also build healthy bodies? Daphne Miller's a physician and professor of family medicine at UC San Francisco. She lays out her vision of farm-inspired medicine in a new book called Pharmacology, and she's here with us today on 45 North. Daphne, so glad to have you here today.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah. So you recently spent a year or more traveling to small, sustainable, innovative farms around the country, picking up tips and techniques that you then sort of try out on your patients. What got you thinking about bringing farming together with medicine?
It was a long process. I have actually been teaching and writing and prescribing food for over a decade in my practice. And my last book was called The Jungle Effect. It was about the healing effects of traditional diets from around the world. And I'm embarrassed to say, with all that work on whole foods and nutrition, that I really hadn't given a lot of thought to how that food was grown. And it was at a certain point when I realized that, you know, I really was only telling my patients and my readers half the story, and I needed to start to investigate. And I, you know, had spent some time on farms as a child, but didn't know very much at all about the insides of farming. I had the same buzzwords as everybody. Things like organic or free range or non-GMO were the words, the pointers I would give my patients in terms of how to seek out food. But what was really going on a healthy farm, I had no idea.
Well, you tell the story in your book about an early insight. You were reading, you picked up this farming manual, and you realized that it sounded like a medical report. Now, I would not think that that would be the case. What is it about a farming manual that seemed like a medical report?
Well, it was quite amazing to me. It was something I actually found in the free box of a bookstore. It was pretty haphazard. But I sat down and read it. It was a book called The Soul of Soil by Grace Gershuni and Joe Smiley, I think is how you, Smiley is how you pronounce his name. And what it did was it told master gardeners and farmers how to keep healthy soil. And as I'm reading this thing, first of all, I could tell that the anatomical description of soil sounded incredibly similar to what the way our intestines are structured, or the way our skin is structured, with layers, and then the roots or the hairs or the villi of the intestine that move in through the layers, and the bacteria that are there on the surface to harvest the organic nutrients and, you know, either move them to the plant or, in our case, move it into our bloodstream and nourish us. And then as I'm reading along, I realize that the pH of soil is pretty much identical to the ideal pH of our bodies, and the carbon to nitrogen ratio of soil, and soils mainly made up of carbon and nitrogen, is pretty identical to the carbon to nitrogen ratio of our bodies.
Oh, did you wind up thinking we are soil?
Exactly. At a certain point, I was just saying, I was like, you know, all those carbohydrates and fats and proteins in our body, where do they come from? Oh my goodness, they come from soil. I'm embarrassed that it took me these many years to figure that out. But, you know, via plants and via animals that eat plants. But essentially, we are soil in a slightly different form.
Well, so you can see the jump you made then from, well, wow, I wonder then if there are lessons, health lessons to be taken from farmers, especially sustainable or innovative farmers who are pioneering kind of new ways of farming. So you set out to visit a bunch of different farms, and you started kind of literally looking at dirt or soil. You visited this biodynamic farm. What did you find there?
Well, I have to tell you that it's interesting that you describe it as a biodynamic farm, because it was, but I didn't even know what biodynamic meant when I went to this farm. That's how basic it was for me. And I was just, I had talked to this farmer, Eric Hawkinson, and he's in Washington State, about an hour east of Seattle. And he acted on the phone like he had been sitting there his whole life waiting for a doctor to call him and ask him for advice. And it was just this incredible synergy. Just over the phone, he had all these wonderful, what I call farm to body lessons for me, ways, you know, that he felt that we should keep ourselves healthy based on what he'd learned in the soil.
Like what?
But well, in terms of rejuvenation, in terms of the fact, he said, you know, in farming, we have this saying, you know, that you should treat the soil and not the plant. Meaning that, you know, we really focus on the plant because that's what's growing out of the soil. But it's actually what lies deep within that whole ecosystem within, which is what's keeping that plant healthy. And in medicine, we do that same thing. You know, the plant being whatever the symptom is, you know, the
sore
depression
throat,
the sore throat or whatever. And we don't often look at what's going on deep inside all the other factors that are leading to whatever that surface symptom is. You know, the low back pain. Yeah. The insomnia. And, many times it is that same thing where we try to reduce it down to one diagnosis or one errant, you know, part of our organism rather than thinking about the big picture of our ecosystem, both in terms of our own body, looking at our body as a whole, but also looking at how our body interacts with the larger ecosystem of our family and our environment and our work and the food that we eat and so on. So, you know, this is where our conversation started. And then when I went to the farm, it really was a series of revelations for me.
Well, this was a farm where they'd started with incredibly depleted soil, right? And the first thing they did, I think, was what a lot of people would do. They had the soil tested and discovered that they were missing, you know, this mineral and that mineral. And the guy said he put, what, thousands of dollars worth of minerals.
Thousands of tons and thousands of dollars of imported minerals on his soil trying to fix it. Yeah.
Right, which you can see the medical, I mean, think of all the drugs that we take to try to fix certain conditions. But so then I'm trying to figure out what did he decide to do instead that worked, and then what would be the medical parallel?
Well, the story that he told me was a really fascinating one. He said that he actually, threw out all his traditional agronomy textbooks, his science soil textbooks, and started reading writings by the grandmothers and grandfathers of organic agriculture. People like F.H. King and Rudolf Steiner and Lady Balfour and Sir Albert Howard. And what all of these agricultural philosophers wrote about was how traditional farmers farmed in all over the world, farmers who were trying to keep their soil healthy for generation after generation. And what all of these philosophers noticed was that these farmers farmed in the same way that nature farms, by keeping the soil covered at all times and recycling all their nutrients back into the soil and using local seeds and always farming with animals. This is what you find in any natural setting. And as a result of doing all these things, what they're able to do is foster those billions of bacteria and fungi that live under the surface of the soil, the so-called unpaid workers who are really what are keeping that soil healthy, all those billions and billions of bacteria. And they're harvesting organic matter and feeding the roots. And this is what finally turned Eric's farm around, was this biodynamic way of returning all the organic matter to the soil and having full cycle farming. And so when I heard this, I said, well, I was thinking of a specific patient of mine who was very depleted and had tried to turn her own health around by testing and replacing. She'd had lots of labs done, and then had, you know, gone to all these practitioners and gotten prescriptions and vitamins and was taking all this stuff and wasn't feeling any better, the same way that Eric Soil wasn't getting better when he was putting all those imported minerals on it. And I asked myself, what would happen if she became part of a healthy farm cycle like Eric's? And in each chapter of pharmacology, I turn at a certain point to biomedical experts or researchers for, you know, to help me along with these questions as I try and integrate them. And so I ended up spending time with a microbiologist at Stanford named Justin Sonnenberg. And he's been doing his research, albeit it's on mice, but finding that when we eat from these kinds of environments, that in turn, we actually start to develop a healthier bacterial population in our intestines. So in essence, we become as healthy as the soil that we are eating from.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that's sort of thinking about the intestines as kind of the human biome. You know, it's the parallel to the soil that the plants grow out of in the farm. So I've been reading about lately, I think there is more and more research being done on the microbes in our guts.
It's really just this exploding field, these billions of bacteria that are not part of our DNA, but that run our metabolism and, you know, determine our immune status and maybe even determine, you know, whether or not we develop diabetes and heart disease. I mean, it's just quite amazing.
And so we're talking about more than just going to the drugstore and getting some of those probiotics and taking them.
Well, no one has the right answer on how to give yourself the healthiest population of these bacteria. And we know that a certain number of them are inherited from birth. I mean, the same way that you inherit your DNA, although it's probably passed more in utero or during the birth canal. So part of them really are, you know, inherited, but there's this other piece that we can do to modulate this population and make it the healthiest profile of bacteria possible. And we're finding that the environments where our food is grown and the quality of that food itself have a lot to do with making the healthier profile of bacteria. And, you know, it might be the bacteria part of it that's hitchhiking on the food. So I always tell people, when you're eating food from someplace that's really healthy, don't wash it too much and certainly don't peel it, you know.
Really?
Who knows?
Eat like the outer kind of messy leaves on the food?
Exactly. Who knows what kind of healthy information you're getting? By contrast, there's researchers at Washington University of St. Louis that are finding that if you eat food that's grown in unhealthy soil, soil that's been treated with a lot of pesticides or herbicides, that those bugs on that food might actually contain DNA codes that tell the bugs in our intestine to act more like superbugs. You know, so that salmonellas and shigellas, all those things that cause disease, you know. So there might be a transference of bad information as a result of eating food that's grown in bad soil.
So how much difference could microbes in the guts make to people's health?
Oh, we're finding that it makes a huge difference. And, you know, in fact, diseases like inflammatory bowel disease are linked back to, you know, like Crohn's or ulcerative colitis. They're finding that in children, whether or not they go on to develop allergies or asthma or eczema might be related to it. I mean, there's certain populations of gut bacteria that seem to be more linked to obesity or heart disease. You know, we recently found that connection between meat eating, interacting with the bugs in our intestine, predisposing you to coronary artery disease.
Well, wait, but they're now thinking that certain microbes in the gut might actually lead to obesity?
There is not going to be one thing that we find that causes obesity, but that it might actually be part of the bigger picture in terms of these bugs being the ones who are, you know, harvesting too many calories from our food. And so, but it's a chicken or egg thing. You put the wrong foods in, you grow the wrong bugs, you know,
right.
And then they harvest the wrong. And the bugs that harvest more calories from our food, which are called firmicutes, tend to be the same bugs that thrive on, you know, fast food. I call them the Homer Simpson bugs.
Well, that's so interesting because what you're saying, because I would think that, well, for instance, big pharmaceutical companies, you could imagine them rolling out a line of different kinds of microbes in capsules that you can take, you know, the thin microbes that will, you'll swallow them and they'll magically make you thinner. But I think the, of course, the gist of what you're saying is it doesn't work that way. You can't just swallow a capsule and magically adjust the microbes in your gut. It's going to be individual for everybody.
Absolutely. And of course, the pharmaceutical industries are trying to do this. But you have to think about it. You know, we don't even know what is a healthy gut profile for each individual, you know. And so, you know, they're coming up with your sort of standard healthy gut profile. But we each actually have our own biomes that work better for us. And, you know, they're regional. There's one amazing study that showed that Asian cultures who have been eating seaweed for thousands of years have a segment of DNA in their bacteria in their gut that's really, really good at digesting seaweed. But it turns out that they're able to trace that segment of DNA back to a bacteria that lives on seaweed in the ocean.
Wow.
So what happened was the bacteria in the ocean actually from that region passed that seaweed digesting ability on to the microbes of seaweed eating people. So we're constantly having this game of swap the gene with these environments where our food is grown.
We are literally what we eat. We're talking with physician. We're talking with physician Daphne Miller about her new book, Pharmacology: What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. She's a practicing physician and professor of family medicine at UC San Francisco. And I know there are a lot of people with farm connections listening. So if you are a farmer or a grower, maybe you grew up on a farm, what health lessons did you learn from the experience? 800-642-1234 if you've got a question or comment, or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page, which is 45 North on WPR. I'm Ann Strange Champs. You're listening to 45 North. Later this hour, we'll be checking in with Wisconsin wild forager Sam Thayer to find out what is wild and edible and waiting to be picked right now. But we are also talking with physician Daphne Miller about her new book, Pharmacology: What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. Daphne, for me, one of the most powerful examples you give in the book has to do with cancer treatment. And you suggest that we might actually make more progress in treating cancer if we borrowed a concept from modern farming, integrated pest management?
Integrated pest management has actually been around since the time of Richard Nixon. And ironically, Richard Nixon was the same president that declared a chemical war on cancer, but wanted us to find a more holistic way of dealing with pests in the field. It was a very paradoxical kind of plan that he developed. The idea behind integrated pest management is that we're never going to be able to fully overcome a pest through pesticides and herbicides and, you know, literally blasting it out. And all we're going to end up doing is creating pest resistance, you know, mutations in the pest that make it so that it overcomes whatever weapon you're using. So instead, the idea is to use a multitude of sort of gentler ways of just controlling the pest and living at peace with the pest and allowing whatever crop is there to thrive and keeping the pest at bay.
Well, I
and
think so, more than that, even sometimes it turns out the pest is an important part of the farm's ecosystem. If you get rid of that pest, worse pests might appear.
Absolutely. Unintended consequences is one of the big rules in integrated pest management. You never know what worse thing might befall you if that pest goes away.
So are there any oncologists taking this approach to cancer?
Yeah. So there's a number of them now, but one in particular who I spent time with is a guy named Bob Gattenby, and he's not an oncologist by training. He's a radiologist by training. But, you know, when you're a radiologist, you see lots of cancer on the screen, you know, mm-hmm. as you're reading these slides. And he just became fascinated with how much we were just thinking in one way about cancer. We were thinking about it in the same way we used to think about pests, that you should just bomb it out, nuke it out, cut it out, you know, and obliterate it. And he realized that within cancer, that was not leading to gains in survival, especially for people who had already had metastatic or invasive cancer. And so he started to read about these forward-thinking farmers who were practicing integrated pest management, where they were using a multitude of ways to control the ecosystem to keep the pests at bay. And he said, we can do the same thing in our bodies. We can do the same thing with cancer. Cancer, he is discovering, you know, grows a lot faster if, for example, it's in a high sugar environment or a high acid environment. Or cancer cells tend to be the ones that survive more if there's less blood flow to the area, where our normal cells tend to not do well. And so he started to look really at the ecosystem of cancer and figure out how can we support other cells and other conditions in our body to keep healthy cells thriving and to keep the cancer cells at bay. And that's really been the focus of his research. And it's gaining traction. These researchers call themselves a whole number of things, from integrated evolutionary oncologists mm-hmm. to ecological oncologists. They have different ways of labeling themselves.
Wow. And are any of these treatments that people can actually get now?
Well, it's starting to make inroads into certain, like prostate cancer and breast cancer, with this idea that they're not doing a one-size-fits-all approach anymore. They're really trying to look at the patient and the balance between healthy cells and tumor cells, and figuring out, you know, how to, for example, and for people with advanced prostate cancer, it used to be that you just gave them these huge doses of Lupron, you know, to block testosterone levels, and they were having all these reactions to the Lupron. But now there's studies coming out showing that, you know, you can measure testosterone levels, measure different drug levels of hormones, and give gentler doses. And, you know, as long as the cancer's kind of behaving itself, you don't blast it, you know. Mm-hmm. And just this, because, you know, there's that saying, you know, we won the fight against the cancer. Unfortunately, the patient didn't make it. And that just does not work.
So what do you now tell your patients who have cancer or maybe a precancerous condition?
Well, first of all, I do need to make it clear that most of what Bob Gattenby and his colleagues are doing is purely experimental at this point. I mean, they've mm-hmm. won awards like, you know, a promising investigation award from the NIH. This is not stuff that's being, that, you know, most oncologists are. Yes, and I need to make that very clear. And I don't want people to stop doing cancer treatment that they're being given by their oncologist. This is all stuff that's really just coming on board now. But one of the things that I really, it's changed my way that I understand cancer and that I talk about it with my patients. I think of it much less as this horrible, devastating invader and more as a nuisance, as a pest that we have to figure out how to keep at bay. And, you know, to figure out a way, in many cases, that people can live with cancer. I mean, I have a patient with ovarian cancer who's been going on now for 7 or 10 years, you know, and that's a little bit unusual. But with some of the newer treatments, what they're doing in her case is indeed keeping the cancer at bay and still allowing her to thrive, you know.
Of course, some of this involves a changing mindset for patients. I mean, I think a lot of us would prefer to the rip it out, nuke it approach. I mean, if I had cancer, I would prefer the feeling that it's just, you've just eradicated it from my body. I'm not sure I want it to, I don't think I want to live with it for another 10, 20 years.
Absolutely. And in some, when it's a very early localized cancer, that is the best approach, quite honestly, is, you know, cut it out. But, you know, now, for example, prostate cancer, which I'm going back to that because it is one of those ones where there's huge amounts of controversy in terms of treatment. And there are so many men that say, cut it out. And, you know, we're finding that they have many more side effects from the surgery and are having the same recurrence rates as men who are taking a little bit more of a pest management approach, mm-hmm. you know, with a little bit of radiation and a little bit of hormone therapy to keep it at bay and so on.
That's fascinating. I want to go to some calls. We've got Rick in Soldiers Grove giving us a call. Hey, Rick, how are you?
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. When we were on the farm, we were told when we got a cut, put some fresh cow manure on it, which seemed really weird. But
wow,
that's what they recommended. And I did it, and I didn't die, and all that stuff. You got to wonder, you know.
Wow, that just seems like, yeah, rub some germs right into that cut.
Yeah, right.
Daphne, any reaction?
Well, first, I would really hope that you'd had a tetanus shot first, but I'm an integrative physician, so I sort of straddle the worlds between biomedicine and the natural world. So I have to use both my brains when I'm talking to folks, and I do believe in tetanus shots. It's interesting because necessarily recommend treating a wound with cow manure. But what we are finding is that kids that grow up on farms have much healthier, if it's a healthy farm, if it's a farm like I just described, like Eric's farm, where it's full cycle farming, they have much healthier immune systems. They have less asthma. They have less allergies than kids who grew up in urban areas or kids who grow up on industrial farms. And so there
and
is really
think some of that. Do they think some of that might have to do with contact with manure?
Yes, manure, with dust, with animals, with eating those vegetables that have the soil still on them. I mean, this cow-calf farmer that I worked with in Missouri, he was so funny. His name was Cody Holmes, and he had a beautiful farm. But he was very upset because his daughter was a nurse, and he said, she's so antibiotic. She's always wiping her children with Sani wipes. I just wish I could feed them some manure. So, you know, but truly there is something to this early and sustained micro exposure to all the organisms on the farm and, you know, the milk on the farm that comes fresh from the animals that has protective bacteria in it. And then there's all those wonderfully nutritious vegetables that, you know, they're pulling directly out of the soil too, that have tons of antioxidants and.
We're talking with physician Daphne Miller about her new book, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. If you're a farmer or a grower, or maybe you grew up on a farm, what health lessons did you learn from the experience? 800-642-1234. You're welcome to join the conversation. Or you can leave us a message on our Facebook page if you're a shy person. That's 45 North on WPR. Now, you also visited, Daphne, this person who calls himself or herself a chicken whisperer and learned some lessons about stress. So what's a chicken whisperer?
Chicken whisperer. He called himself that, Matt O'Hare. And he's actually, he was someone I had a lot of exchanges with over the phone, but actually didn't visit his farm. But he runs Vital Farms, which is a farming cooperative for pasture-raised eggs. And it really is a way for these small-scale farmers to be able to band together and sell to a big company like Whole Foods, whereas, you know, if they were just the individuals, they wouldn't have Whole Foods as a customer. But what I did was I visited one of Matt's farms, which was in Arkansas, and it was a fascinating experience. And like every chapter in pharmacology, it turned out that the model of farming there offered me some wonderful lessons to give to my patients. And then the foods produced from that model also were the healthiest foods. It was just this, everything always marched through in every mm-hmm. instance. And so in this case, it really was an investigation into stress, because I was comparing hens that were raised in a high density indoor environment to hens that were being raised on pasture, because they were both on the same farm. They were the same breed of hens, and yet they had these two very different farming methods, mainly because they were trying to run two businesses in tandem. It's a, mm-hmm. it's a little bit of an interesting story, and you can read the details in the book if you want. But what I found out, I'd always had this incredibly naive idea about pasture-raised hens, that they were just living in this hen nirvana, you know. And what I found out is they have their own stressors. You know, they've got wild cats that can come and pick them off, or hawks, or thunderstorms, or their beaks are left on, whereas the ones in the high-density environment, the tips of the beaks are taken off at birth so they won't pluck each other.
Oh.
But the pasture-raised hens still have their beaks so they can attack each other.
Huh.
And, you know, so there's all these things about being pasture-raised that all of a sudden I realized are stressful, you know.
Right, so it's but not then, the stress-free life.
It's not the stress-free life. But then, once again, as in every chapter, I went and I visited an expert, a biomedical expert. In this case, it was a guy named Bruce McEwen, who's he's a stress guru. He's a very famous stress researcher at Rockefeller University in New York. And he's actually studied stress in chickens and in humans. And I asked him, what is the difference between these two stressors, the barn stress and, high-density barn stress and the pasture stress? And he said, well, that's really the difference between good stress and bad, in that the pasture hens, even though they're stressed, what it is, it's a dramatic stress, but then it goes away. It's more what our innate fight or flight's response system is geared to deal with, you know, like getting up to give a speech, or me being on public radio first thing in the morning, you know, that kind of thing. But then your immune system, your stress system calms down. Versus the hens who are in this high density barn, that's more like your boss yelling at you all day, you being in a windowless office, eating junk food for lunch, not being able to see your family and your kids, not being able to exercise. You know, there's nothing that's real high drama, but it's just wear and tear on the stress system, and wear and tear on the immune system. And that's what causes, when we say that stress makes us sick, it's that kind of stress,
that's
right. Kind of low-grade chronic stress. So, I learned from that, I need to be a pasture hen. How do I turn my life into a pasture hen?
Right.
And Bruce McEwen told me, well, there's two things that those pasture hens have that is very important. He said, first of all, they have behavioral freedom, meaning that they can act like hens. You know, they can roost, they can dust bathe, they can run around, they can gossip. And, you know, we as humans have things that for us are our requirements, you know, that make us feel like we have choice or freedom. So how do you seek those out in your life? And then the other thing he explained to me is that the pasture hens, because they are only 5,000 to a house, and because they have a quarter acre of land to run on and so on, they're actually able to make social networks more than those high density hens. They're more like the hens, you know, they're more like living in Manhattan with millions of other people, and yet somehow you can't make any friends because, you know, everybody's mm-hmm. a stranger to each other. And so having a social network and having this choice or behavioral freedom are really recipes for managing your stress in your life.
Oh, lessons from the chickens. Okay, let's see what some other folks have to say. We've got Fawn in Madison on the line. Hi, Fawn.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to tell you about how in 1995 I was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. It was really in really, really bad condition. I went out to, some of the first things I did were to go out to visit some friends in the countryside and get some fresh air, sleep outdoors in a field of daisies, eat good organic food. And then as soon as I was healthy enough to travel back to the Midwest, and I applied for an organic farm internship. It was a real leap of faith for the farmers to take me on because I had no guarantees that I'd be able to fulfill the duties of the job. And I must say that that was the hardest physical work, labor that I'd ever done in my life by a long shot. But thanks be to God and the entire wonderful nature of the organic system and life, my stamina improved as the duties of the farm gradually, in a really natural, or literally organic way, picked up. At first, in the early spring, we're just putting seeds into little seedling trays, And then later on, we're planting, and then weeding, and then by and by, we're, you know, then we're harvesting, and as the season goes on, the crops become heavier and heavier. Like, first you have just lettuce, and at the end of the season, you're getting pumpkins, you know, the difference. So by doing all this work constantly and being in the outdoors and fresh air, free from chemicals and all the indoor stressors, I must say, and then eating good organic food all the time.
And do you feel like that?
My health improved. And so my health improved vastly. I had been previously very highly sensitive. I couldn't tolerate bright lights or any fluorescent lights even. And then I became able to, you know, do the packing in the barn under the fluorescent lights by and by. And
well, I'm curious, did your attitude toward your body change, do you think, as a result of being on the farm, being part of an organic system?
I just felt blessed. I mean, maybe not in every single moment was I feeling the joy of feeling that blessing, but I really felt that everything about it contributed to building up my physical and spiritual and psychological health. They're all in tandem. They're all interconnected with each other.
Well, thanks for sharing your story, Daphne. That seems like a perfect illustration of what you've been talking about.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And there's so many wonderful things that this caller just said. Even in terms of all of a sudden her biorhythms becoming more in tune with nature, which is really what we're supposed to be doing. It's incredible how much we can even fix sleep problems by, you know, connecting ourselves more to the cycles of light and darkness and less, you know, and living in an internal environment. And there's a lot of chronobiology research coming out exactly on that. But I also have to say that I've heard so many stories about the healing or rehabilitative power of healthy farms. And there really is a movement afoot for, you know, farm therapy or, you know, this idea of, you know, biophilia that was introduced by E.O. Wilson, you know, 40, 50 years ago. But this idea that innately we as humans need to be connected to growing things and to healthy forms of nature, you know.
So it's not a bad idea if you're, you know, I mean, maybe someday in the future people will take rest cures at farms to,
well,
you know.
We used to. We used to, you know, that, remember Heidi who went to the mountains, you know,
yes.
But that idea, I think, is very much coming back.
Oh, we've got time for one more very quick call. Randy in Ripon. Hi, Randy.
Hi. I'm in agreement with the organic farms and stuff, but you made a comment about, the allergies and stuff that having them, is due to being too clean. But I just wanted to point out, I'm 56 years old, and I spent the first 5 years of my life living on my grandparents' farm, and all of my young adult and childhood helping on my aunt and uncle's farm, cleaning barns. I mean, getting swatted on the side of the face by a tail full of manure. And I've worked in construction all my life, and I have allergies like you wouldn't believe. They're primarily tree allergies, and I take exception to that because it's anecdotal, and I know too many friends and acquaintances that grew up in similar situations on farms that have allergies. And you are not clean on a farm or working in construction. You can rest assured of that.
Okay, let's see what Daphne has to say. Thanks.
Yes, that's a wonderful comment. First of all, I need to make it very clear. It's not anecdotal, this information about children who are growing up on healthy farms who have low rates of allergy or asthma. It's actually been studied. There was a paper published about this in the New England Journal of Medicine, which is one of the most, you know, premier biomedical journals in the world. But what it is it's truly on farms where the farm and the soil are treated in this very healthy way. And as I made clear, that in fact, in a farm that's using chemicals or pesticides or that has, you know, a lot of sort of environmental pollutants, those farms, in fact, can be the worst and the least healthy. I mean, we see the highest rate of respiratory diseases in people who work, for example, in those internal chicken houses. They get like an asbestos type lung, basically, from, you know, the same thing that asbestos would do to them. From working in the manure, it really destroys their lungs in the same way.
I think the point that you make in the book really is that we're at the very beginning to see and tease out some of these connections, but there's clearly some really exciting research that's going on. So thank you so much for talking with us today. It's been great.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Daphne Miller is a practicing physician and professor of family medicine at UC San Francisco. She's been talking about her new book, Pharmacology, What Innovative Family Farming Can Teach Us About Health and Healing. There's a lot more about what she talked about in the book. If you want to know more, you will find links and background on our Facebook page. That's 45 North on WPR. Next, if you are in the mood to green your diet, wild forager Sam Thayer joins us from northern Wisconsin to tell us what is wild and edible and waiting to be picked right now. Sam Thayer is someone I think of as a Wisconsin treasure. He's an internationally recognized authority on edible wild plants and wild foraging, and we reached him in northern Wisconsin. Hey, Sam, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Ann.
Yeah. So what is out there right now? If we don't want to wait for the farmer's market, we just want to get outside into the wild green. Is there actually stuff out there that's edible right now?
Oh, there's so much stuff right now. I wouldn't know where to begin. But quite interestingly, there's a gray fox right outside my window now that I'm watching him forage in my compost pile. We have right now wild leeks are kind of at the peak of their season. And I think of that because after I get off the phone with you, I'm probably going to go collect some to make some soup. If your listeners don't know, wild leeks also go by the name of ramps. And ramps is actually a better name. The plant was called ramson in England, or a very closely related plant was called ramson in England, and then it was shortened when settlers came over here. But it's a broad-leafed onion, looks almost like a lily of the valley, but it's got a strong oniony, garlicky scent, and it makes great soup. I make very much like French onion soup, just adapted it to the ramps. So I'll take the bulbs and part of the tops and caramelize them for about an hour with some butter, and then put in beef broth, thyme, and Swiss cheese. Very simple recipe.
That sounds amazing.
But it turns out great.
So are they hard to find? I mean, I live in the middle of Madison.
Well, it all depends. You know, what you can forage on depends totally on your environment. Wherever you are, there's stuff to forage. But, you know, certain parts of the state, ramps are extremely common. I mean, there's literally millions of acres of them. And other parts of the state, they're not so common. They're not very common in south central or southeastern Wisconsin. They're real spotty in southwestern Wisconsin, but they become real common in the northern half to two-thirds of the state, mostly under rich hardwood forests, sugar maple-type forests. But in an urban setting, a plant that's peak right now is shepherd's purse, which is a mustard. And we've got about 45 different edible species of wild mustard growing in the Midwest. But in my opinion, shepherd's purse is the premier mustard.
Well, I know people always talk about garlic mustard because there are those picking parties to go out and try to eradicate it. But what is shepherd's purse?
Well, shepherd's purse, everybody has seen it as a weed in gardens or yards or sidewalk cracks or farm fields. And it's the leaf, when it is small, almost looks like a dandelion leaf, but it doesn't have the milky sap of a dandelion leaf. And then the stalk has a real distinct cluster of seed pods. The pods are triangular shape, and that's where the name shepherd's purse comes from, because supposedly that's the shape of some bag the shepherds used to carry somewhere. When the plant is in its tender growth stage in early spring, those shoots are just, they're somewhat like if you peel the outside of a broccoli stalk. Uh-huh. You know how that center of that broccoli stalk tastes? It's like that with a little hint of pepper. It's just a really mild, really delicious vegetable, and you can have it raw or just steamed quickly, really like you would use broccoli.
So I always love talking with you because you open up a whole new window to foods that are all around us that I didn't even know existed. I guess I want to ask you about kind of the philosophical argument for wildcrafting, foraging for edible wild plants, because, I mean, it's fun and cool to think that we could, but why does it matter?
Well, you know, there's a whole bunch of different reasons that it matters to different people, and they're all good and valid and exciting reasons. One of the things that I find so fascinating about foraging is these foods that seem strange to us, we realize when we research them a little bit that they're only strange because of our particular place geographically and in time and culturally. So if we were to go to northern Asia, northern China, shepherd's purse would be a much more normal food, a much more widely accepted, regularly eaten vegetable. And that's fascinating. It's almost like you can travel around to different food cultures by foraging, and a lot of these are foods that you couldn't go buy. We have a real common herb growing wild all over Wisconsin. It doesn't really have a good common name in our language. It has a scientific name, but it's sometimes called honewort or wild chervil. In Japanese, it's known as mitsuba, and it's a commonly eaten vegetable. It also grows wild in Japan and Korea, as well as Eastern North America. And it's just absolutely delicious. It's just amazing to me how one culture ignores a particular food and another culture adores the same food.
And you wrote something I wanted to ask you about that's fascinating to me, that that not only are we ignoring a lot of edible plants that might be all around us, but we've also become, as modern civilized folks, very out of touch with our sense of taste. That there are tastes and taste sensations that we've simply lost contact with, aren't familiar with anymore.
Well, you know, humans are inherently really conservative when it comes to food. So basically, people eat the food they grew up eating, and anything that they didn't grow up eating, they have to try several times or be convinced to try before they can like it. And it's really fun to just step outside of the really limited food choices that most of us have. If we examine our diets and look at what plants our diets trace back to, it's often shockingly simple. And I often like to say to people, you know, some people think that spaghetti and cheeseburgers are different food. And they stop and look at me real strangely, like, but aren't they? And I say, no, they're wheat and beef and cheese, and one has a little more tomato than the other. You know, but we think they're different food. And that's how simplified our diets are. And so to step outside of Western civilization diet based on, you know, 17 or so plants that comprise almost all of our calories, and then, you know, 6 or 7 different animals, you can have all these flavors that you've never experienced, and once you get used to them, you'll love them, you'll crave them, there's inherent value in food variety, because it gives you a nutritional variety.
Sam, thank you, and we will have you back again in another few weeks to talk even more. It's been great talking with you. Thanks.
All right. Well, thank you, Ann.
Sam Thayer is an authority on edible wild plants and a member of the National Wild Foods Hall of Fame. He's written 2 books on edible wild plants, Forager's Harvest and Nature's Garden. And we want to leave you with a little taste of what it's like to get out and about in the green. This is Wisconsin Life producer Erica Janik and Danny Lind, watercress gathering.
There's a spring. Oh, there's a spring right there coming out of the side of the hill. See?
Yeah.
And all that watercress over there. That would be the good patch to get. There's some watercress.
Oh, yeah.
It grows all year round. It's a perennial. And in really protected spots, you can harvest it all winter if it's a spring that stays open. Summertime is generally not the best time. It doesn't like the heat. It'll get kind of yellow, and it'll bolt, have little flowers on it, and it'll get super spicy and kind of bitter.
So you just snip off the tops?
Yep, snip off the tops. You never want to pull it out unless you're trying to thin out the patch a lot. But if you're someplace where you're wildcrafting it, it's definitely the considerate and responsible thing to do to leave the roots in the ground so they can just grow right back. watercress isn't native to the U.S., but it's so naturalized that it just about might as well be. When people would come west, they would bring a little bit with them and plant it, and it pretty much just took over after that. A lot of the creeks around here are pretty darn clean. Streams that are good trout streams are good indicators of a pretty clean creek. There's a trout.
Wow.
Oh, there's a whole bunch of them.
It moves so fast.
They're little babies.
I've never seen a fish move so fast.
Yeah.
What's your favorite thing to do with watercress?
You know, this time of year, I really like just having a little pile of it on the side of my plate, just about no matter what I'm eating. But it's really good in salads. It's really great in sandwiches. It's really awesome put in an omelet, just like right when you're almost done cooking the omelet, just set in there and fold it over, and it just barely wilts. That's really good. You can make watercress soup just with onions and potatoes and a little bit of milk or cream. I mean, it's one of the most concentrated sources of nutrition you can find.
That's foraging for wild watercress, something any of us could do this weekend if you head out into the wild. You've been listening to 45 North. I'm Ann Strainchamps. That was Erica Janik and Danny Lind talking about picking wild watercress. We also heard from Daphne, I'm forgetting her name, Miller, and her book, Pharmacology. And 45 North is produced by a lot of terrific people. Thanks for listening.